To order for March 6, 2012. And we have five bills before us today. And the first one is Senate File 1734, Senator Gazelka. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this Senate File 1734 is a product of a cooperative effort of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota and the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota, which represents collision repair shops to update Minnesota salvage title statute. Well, we do have a delete everything amendment, Mr. Chair, that I would like to begin with to get the bill in the order. I would like it. I believe.
Is this a author's delete everything amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment.
Senator Gazelka, we don't have a. We'll have to work from this until we have a quorum, Senator Gazelka.
But okay. All right.
To the A1 amendment, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I have with me today Bob Johnson of the Insurance Federation and Kevin Wally representing the Alliance of Automobile Service Providers. They're the ones that have worked together to bring this bill forward, and I'd like them to explain it.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kevin Wally. I represent the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota. We've been working with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota for about 18 months on the issues relating to our salvage title statutes. This began with the two associations working with one another in order to come to a clear understanding of what the existing law said, and in so doing, and developing a white paper that provided that explanation to ourselves, we resolved that there was a need for some updating of the statutes and some clarification. So what I would like to do is walk briefly through the delete everything amendment. It's fairly technical, but I'll cover the issues, and then Bob Johnson and I can stand for questions. The first section of the delete everything amendment, we're amending the definition of high-value vehicle. The $5,000 threshold, which is currently in statute, was established some 20 years ago, and after some negotiations and discussions with organizations such as the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, we resolved that that updated number should be $9,000. The second section modifies the definition of late model vehicle. This is really more of a technical change than a substantive change. In the delete everything amendment, we're making reference to the manufacturer's designated model year rather than the year that the vehicle was manufactured. It's just a matter of being able to determine, because of what the manufacturer says, what that year should be. The third section modifies the definition of older model vehicle. It's simplifying the statute, so it defines an older model vehicle as a vehicle other than a late model vehicle, which is a newer vehicle. Section 4 provides a somewhat wider window for insurance companies to report to the commissioner when they have taken a title of a vehicle through payment of damages. There was a 48-hour rule. We're changing that to 10 days to provide just a little bit more opportunity for the insurance companies to make that filing. Section 5 makes a technical change in the reference to late model vehicle simply by removing the word motor. It also captures the change of the threshold to 80% of the value of a vehicle that's been damaged. What we're doing here is we're removing the separate calculation of the cost of repairing safety restraint systems, and it was 70%, and then the separate calculation, and we're just blending that into a single calculation, and we're doing that in a couple of places in the statute. And finally, for the form of disclosure, we're making a similar change with respect to the threshold, removing the reference to the repairs and to have consistency throughout the statutes. So that's what we've done. As I said, it's about 18 months of effort that led to these adjustments, if you will, to the salvage title statute.
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The only thing I would add to Kevin Wally's comments, Mr. Chairman, is that we have met with Pat McCormick and the staff at the Department of Public Safety and reviewed all the changes, and there's no issues from the DPS's perspective that administers this area of the law. So we believe with all of the bases touched that we need to touch base again from the private sector associations, the auto dealers, Kevin Wally's client and the Insurance Federation, that those are all the impacted parties along with the state agency, and we'd urge your support for the bill, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gazelka, or whoever, I'm just, you know, I have to look at this where it says subdivision 6A, where we say we're just kind of clarifying. What's the difference? I mean, how do you designate what the difference is between a late model vehicle in this? I mean, is it stated somewhere what the years, what designates a late model vehicle?
In the early section, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, in the early section of the Delete Everything Amendment, the late model vehicle definition is provided as a vehicle with a manufacturer's designated model year equal to or greater than the fifth calendar year immediately preceding the current calendar year.
Ah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I
you had to ask.
I read over it, and for some reason that just didn't stick. But I've got it now. Thank you. It's not often that happens either.
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, that's what you think.
Mr. Chair, there is a small fiscal note. That's why eventually when we have a quorum, it needs to go to finance. We're hoping to get that worked out on the way there, but that's where it'll eventually go.
Well, as you mentioned, we don't have a quorum quite yet, so I think what we'll do is lay this over. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, can you just talk a minute about the fiscal note? I know I'm on the bill with you, but that was a surprise to see a fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinert, we were a little surprised by the fiscal note as well. The explanation that's provided is that with the changes of thresholds, there may be fewer cars for the driver and vehicle services inspectors to inspect, and currently they charge a fee per car inspected. And so when you have fewer cars to inspect, there's fewer dollars flowing in, and so that's the issue, and that's not something we had contemplated in our discussions with them. So we intend to go back to the department and kind of review our conversation from about a month and a half ago or so, and just to see if we can reconcile that between now and the time we get to Finance Committee.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wally. And I would just say, whether it's a surprise or not, I don't know how hard we need to work to reconcile. I mean, this is something we should do, and sometimes the things we should do have costs to the departments doing them, but that's not a reason we should stop doing a good policy, especially if it's based on us continuing to do a particular thing. So move forward, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Reinhardt, you bring up a good point there. If we're doing inspections and we're looking at maybe doing less, this is what gets me about fiscal notes. If we're going to be doing less, why would the fiscal note? That's a question. I think that's why, you know, we've always kind of looked at fiscal notes like, where is it coming from? And this is a good thing, and I think by the time you get to finance, if you have to go there, depending on the fiscal note. Ms. McCormick's going to come in.
Ms. McCormick is here.
Sure, because we have time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Ms. McCormick has some comments as well.
Good. Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. I just wanted to address the issue that Senator Perry just raised because, you know, there is a fee, and the larger portion of the fee affects the general fund. And so that's why we have that fiscal note. I don't know. I have to go back to our staff. We have not been requested to do a fiscal note on the amendment. But from the general comments I've received from our staff, they weren't sure that the fiscal note would change. So we have to go and analyze that with our budget analysts and our staff. So But I just wanted to comment that it's not just the special revenue account, it's also the general fund. So obviously, we know that you are always concerned about any changes in the general fund. So,
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To be clear, I mean, we've put a lot of agencies in the position of driving their own revenue. And so I understand that doing less inspections is going to be a hit not only to the agency, to DVS, but also to the general fund. But I just wanted to be clear that that shouldn't hinder us. I mean, I have a different philosophy on the revenue side in general. But in the case of this bill, I would hope that it wouldn't be a hindrance on the bill moving forward.
Senator Gazalka.
Mr. Chair, and this maybe is for Ms. McCormick, but if we have less inspections, do we then have less FTEs?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator, the inspection staff, we only have three full-time inspectors right now across the state, two in St. Paul and one in Royalton. The rest are all done by our exam staff, who are called exam and inspection specialists. So in addition to their activities of administering road tests and testing individuals, they do inspections as well. So it probably wouldn't change the amount of staff we need. If anything, we support the legislation, as was stated earlier. But obviously, you know, we would look and see. I think we would keep the staff that we currently have just because of their locations, and they have other work that they do in addition to this. So reconstructed vehicles and restored vehicles as well. So.
For the record, a quorum is present. So we can go ahead and act on your bill.
Mr. Chair, I need to move the A1 amendment then.
Senator Gazalka moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can move that this be recommended to pass. I recommend Senate File 1734 be recommended to pass and amended and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Gazalka has moved that Senate File 1734 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Up next, we'll take Senate File 2172, Senator Howe. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2172, what this bill does is this bill establishes a contingency state aid appropriations in the case of a future state government shutdown. Under current law, county and municipal state aid funds are constitutionally dedicated, but they require a state appropriations to be dispersed. This bill would require the disbursement of state aid funds if the budget is not in place at the beginning of the biennium budget cycle. The bill also requires MnDOT, Trunk Highways, and state aid staff to perform duties necessary to keep projects going. Duties include material certification, plan review, testings, and issuing payments. Mr. Chair, I do have two testifiers here, Wayne Sandberg from Washington County Engineer and Lee Gustafson, Minnetonka City Engineer.
Okay, whichever one of you would like to go first, please identify yourself for the record.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Wayne Sandberg. I'm the Washington County Engineer. I'm here to testify in support of this bill, and I appreciate your time this afternoon. The Minnesota Department of Transportation and local agencies are intertwined partners when it comes to construction. Our county state aid highways and municipal state aid funding streams are a key component in our ability to build the local highway systems. This bill would ensure that these funding streams continue during a future state shutdown. Now, the money this bill intends to appropriate is constitutionally dedicated through the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund to local agencies. This is not general fund money. This money cannot be spent anywhere else, and keeping these dollars flowing from the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund Bank to locals so they can carry out their mission is the goal. Additionally, making sure we can keep our local funding sources available ensures we have the resources to meet our requirements for other funds we may have associated with these projects, for example, federal dollars. This is very important because when it comes to construction, our window in Minnesota is small. Every working day we have counts, and all of our contractors operate on a month-to-month financial basis. Our ability to make these payments is critical to keep the contractors solvent during the construction process, thus keeping construction moving forward as scheduled. This bill helps us do that. I'm speaking from experience here. During the shutdown of 2011, we worked very hard to keep portions of our $18 million Broadway Avenue project in Forest Lake going. On that project, we had a freeway interchange removed, and we were only partially done building the new one when everything was stopped. Had that shutdown gone even one more week, we would have jeopardized our completion dates, and it would have become a two-year bridge closure. As it was, we still spent nearly $200,000 in additional construction costs and county staff time managing the additional project complexities during the shutdown. Now, I mentioned earlier that MnDOT and local agencies are intertwined partners when it comes to construction of the local system. We rely on MnDOT expertise that we cannot or do not have on our own staffs. Additionally, all the materials used in our highway projects, the concrete, steel, wiring, sewer pipes, stoplights, bituminous paving, everything we use is tested and certified, and MnDOT provides these services and that expertise, and this bill would ensure that that continues as well. Our goal in supporting this bill is not to insert ourselves into the politics of state budgeting. Rather, once construction begins, it is important in terms of preventing increased costs, keeping traffic delays to a minimum, and making sure our highways are among the safest in the nation. And we want to ensure we can keep these projects moving forward without delay. When we start a construction project, especially at the local level, we have made a promise to the residents and businesses in that community that we're going to build that needed infrastructure and those improvements to support the quality of life and the economic vitality that every citizen wants as quickly and with little impact as possible. Once a project starts, there is no going back. This bill helps us keep these projects moving forward and to keep those promises. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sandberg.
Thank you. Once again, my name is Lee Gustafson. I'm the city engineer for the city of Minnetonka. I'm also representative on the City Engineers Association Legislative Committee and current vice president of the Public Works Association. So I'm here wearing three hats and offering the support from those organizations as well as the city of Minnetonka for this proposed legislation. I'll start off by keeping this actually more brief than I thought, because I agree 100% with how Wayne described how projects develop and our need and uses for MnDOT as a partner in all of our projects. So I won't restate any of that. What I will describe is give you some of our experience with the shutdown of last summer and how it affected the city of Minnetonka. Last year, we were in the process of replacing an interchange on Highway 169 when the shutdown occurred. Very similar to what Wayne had to deal with on his project. It was about $18 million project, and we frankly had to get it done in a very short time frame. With all projects, this project took us several years to develop. In order to address the impacts of the shutdown, we spent hours, weeks, and sometimes almost 6 to 8 hours a day trying to figure out how to address the impacts from the shutdown. We knew we needed to change the construction schedule in hopes of completing the project before the winter set in. I'll explain that in more detail a little later. But we had this goal in mind. We needed to keep this project going and get this project completed. It was determined that we had to, after the shutdown occurred, to condense the construction schedule. And as Wayne mentioned, we take everything into consideration very seriously from our businesses and local residents. And by condensing the construction schedule, we actually had more impacts on the businesses than we really wanted to when originally set out. But the businesses understood they wanted to get this done because they did not want to go and do a second year of construction with either that bridge down or the bridge interchange half complete. I am, however, happy to report we did complete it last year, substantially so. We got everybody back in business. Although we had a very willing contractor to deal with during the shutdown, we still have a significant amount of shutdown claims hanging over our head. We also are currently spending, I'm sure just like all the other agencies, we're spending a considerable amount of time and money trying to figure out how the shutdown is going to affect us and really what claims are legitimate, what aren't, and what is our financial responsibility when we get this all figured out. The most important thing about this is none of us have this money, the claims, earmarked within any of our budgets. So this is something we're going to have to figure out how to pay out of different pockets. In our case, it's coming from the city of Minnetonka because we're the lead agency on that. And somehow the businesses and the taxpayers of Minnetonka are going to have to pay for the shutdown claims. We did make one really good decision last year. We fortunately decided to postpone our June 24th bridge demolition, which, as you know, the timing, the shutdown occurred shortly thereafter. So we decided to postpone that. And it was a good decision for a couple of reasons. One, it lessened our shutdown claims. But more importantly, we were fearful, as Wayne mentioned in his project, if we knocked that bridge down and that shutdown went on, occurred any longer, it could have been just another 2 to 3 weeks. As possible, we wouldn't have been able to reconstruct that bridge in time for the winter. And that whole Opus area would have been without their main gateway. And more importantly, I shouldn't say more important, everything is important, but we had a lot of small retail businesses on the city of Edina that were very concerned about the length of this construction and disruption. We did have other shutdown, I call it non-construction related impacts that you have and sometimes you don't think about. The Opus area in Minnetonka employs about 13,000 to 14,000 people. The interchange that was reconstructed was under capacity for the current Opus businesses and uses and severely under capacity for what we're projecting for future uses. It also, as I mentioned, was a main gateway into this area, and it needed to be reconstructed, obviously, in the shortest time possible. The shutdown, unfortunately, disrupted us, and it had a considerable impact on 13,000 to 14,000 Opus workers. These impacts, obviously, would have been much greater if the shutdown would have continued. We had one example that was really near and dear and tied to this project, and that was United Health Group is currently finishing a second office tower in Opus. It will house 1,750 new jobs. The opening of this building was tied to the completion of this interchange because we needed additional capacity. It was already at capacity, and we needed additional capacity to allow not only United Health Group, but Digital River, Comcast, and other folks be able to expand and develop in there. So we needed this thing done in a timely manner. This opening for this United Health Group building, which, as I mentioned, was 1,750 new jobs for the area, was tied to the completion of this. So fortunately, we were able to get it done, but the opening of this building would have been delayed, and the 750 new jobs or people coming to Opus, that condition would have been delayed as well. Hopefully not too long, but it definitely would have been throughout the 2012. I'm hopeful by providing you a different take on our experiences and maybe some non-construction related impacts, so I'll kind of give you our perspective and provide you with a little more assistance in understanding this legislation, how important passing this legislation is to cities like Minnetonka and counties like Washington. And as I mentioned, we do have support from the City Engineers Association and Public Works Association on this legislation.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to add that the League of Minnesota Cities supports this, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, and also the Association of General Contractors. And this is very similar to what we had for the state transportation, but this does provide some guidance for the local transportation. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2172 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Hall has moved that Senate File 2172 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion?
Roll call.
Roll call has been requested, I believe, is what I heard. We will have a roll call. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I suppose I could just ask to rewind the tape. Or maybe I could ask you to give your brilliant oratory of a couple of days ago. That was great.
Don't make me go there, Senator Dibble.
But I wish, actually, I don't know if folks tuned in to Senator Sharon's press conference and I would invite her to describe a couple of her ideas that she's putting into motion that address this subject in a way that perhaps is a little more meaningful than this approach that would actually get us to a place as a legislature to solve the crux of the issue, which is, of course, the legislature getting its work done, coming to compromise with itself and the governor. This is kind of a, you know, along with these other contingency appropriation bills, an approach to kind of building in a gridlock and really handing the lever of power over to those who are not interested in coming to compromise. That's why I'm concerned about all of these contingency appropriation bills coming forward in all of these committees that we're seeing kind of stack up now. So I'll be happily voting no on the roll call, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lohr?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to echo some of that, and I'm not unsympathetic to the problems. I mean, I actually run a little farm. I know the small window that we have in Minnesota in the summers, and when I get behind, I feel the pressure. But what this is about pressure to get a deal done. And so each of these bills alone sounds like, oh my God, we really need to do this. But when you think of them as a package, what we're seeing in the legislature here is a package of bills, of lights-on bills, that remove the pressure. If these were all to pass and become law, it removes the pressure for the legislature to get our work done and to get it done on time and to secure a governor's signature for a balanced and decent budget package for the people of Minnesota to roll forward with. You know, we've heard this bill on state aid highways. This is the county and municipal side. We heard the similar bills in higher ed. I understand there's ones coming forward in health. We haven't seen those yet. My understanding is judiciary moved forward. These package, you know, if this happened and we just had lights on, it actually creates a situation where we are less likely to get our job done and come to a resolution because it removes the pressure. And so these real pressures, they exist, and I don't mean to downplay them, but I think that we should use these pressures to think about how we come up with a set of policies that make us more likely to come to a resolution rather than making it more likely that we don't within the statutorily within the constitutionally set up framework for us to come to a discussion. So, I mean, I really am sympathetic to the very real and legitimate problems that the state shutdown posed on people all across Minnesota in each of these venues where a lights-on bill has been proposed and moved forward. But I do think that we should take a step back and again, take a look at some of the ideas that Senator Sharon has been working on to take a better look at why we as a legislature didn't succeed in getting a bill passed last year, a set of bills, and try to create an environment where success is more likely rather than less likely. And this package, I think, I personally think goes the wrong way, and respectfully. And I do plan on voting no as well.
Mr. Chair, let me respond to that, would you?
Yeah.
Certainly, Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I appreciate that, and I understand your position. I served on the Transportation Conference Committee last year, I don't think it would have mattered what we would have done in the transportation budget. You know, the transportation wasn't the issue. Transportation was used as a leverage, you know, and had the administration signed that bill, it would have given up some leverage. This bill here, same thing. I'm going to ask for your vote because I don't believe that the local governments should be used as a pawn in a bigger issue dealing with whether or not what we're going to do with another bill somewhere down the line. And that's what transportation got caught into. We had that discussion. You know, 99.6% of transportation money is dedicated funds. We deal with a very small, less, you know, 1% of the budget is in general fund dollars. And that was just used as a leverage. And I think good governance is to take that leverage point out. Why should we use it as a leverage point? Why should it be used in that? And a vote no against this is a vote to say, yeah, let's keep it as a leverage point. Let's use it. I think it, just the opposite. Let's take as many leverage points away as we possibly can. We shouldn't be using, especially local governments, we shouldn't be putting municipalities and counties on the spot because of our failure up here. And I don't want to point fingers back and forth. We shouldn't get into that. That this is trying to go away from doing that. You didn't hear in any of my testimony bringing up someone's name in here. Whatever side you want, I think many of you know me. I want to work across both sides of the aisle, and I want to take as much of it out. I think there are good points of ways we can do that, but don't discount this legislation, because maybe this legislation is a step that we get to something that's even better, where we can keep government operating regardless of what our discussions are on other points. But transportation should not have been one of the leverage points, and we're going to pay for that. The taxpayers are going to pay for that. We've seen it in the claims. We don't even know how much money that's going to be. Even the municipality talked about some of these bills, and we don't know where that money's going to come from. We do know that money's going to keep from not expanding our infrastructure. So I hope we can just limit the discussion to this bill, and I would ask for your vote.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's basically a fundamental difference about what to do when we have an impasse. And what Senator Howell is bringing forth and others are bringing forth is one way to do it, and that is that we don't make the people suffer. You know, and when we talk about use these pressures, we're really making the people of Minnesota suffer. You know, one administration made the choice that as many areas that we could sign and move forward, we would do so that there wouldn't be people frustrated and losing income and not being able to fish. You take your topic. Another administration decided that it was almost all or nothing. And there are two different ways of doing it, but it's really the people that lose out on that. And it's our responsibility to get our work done, and it doesn't have to be at the expense of the people.
Senator Kolk.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I won't belabor the point. We've been, Senator Howe, Senator Gazelka have made some good points on this. I think that there's a difference between, and within the budget, there's plenty of pressure for all of us to get our job done, Senator Laurie. We all should. I think what we're looking at on these individual bills on a case-by-case basis were things that came to light that really seemed common sense, where funding was already there, where it wasn't, even as Senator Howe pointed out, the transportation budget wasn't part of the impasse, and yet they were sort of dragged into everything else. There's ample pressure within all the budgets. Every budget is important. But if we can do some things, some common sense things that help on case-by-case basis where people have already paid. You mentioned higher ed. We had the Minsky bill the funds are sitting there. In fact, the university gets to use those funds. Minsky didn't simply by how they're administered. And indeed, the governor actually allowed those funds being used earlier anyway. So I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. I agree with you. We should not remove the pressure. I think we need to be cautious of any kind of lights-on bill that just runs things, into all time with just open. But there's ample pressure. This is about not using common sense things to score political points. That should never be the case. Whoever's in the administration, who's ever in the legislature. That's what this bill's about, and I'm going to be proud to support it, Senator Howe.
And, one brief comment on the part of the chair, is that transportation is unique. No other agency, I like to think it is anyhow, but it's unique in that now we're going to have to pay claims to resolve some of the contract disputes and the shutdown costs and people being laid off and then coming back to work. That doesn't happen with fishing licenses or motor vehicle tabs and all of that. But in transportation, the costs are huge for not doing that, and it's taking away very difficult to find funds, in a time when we need every dollar we can get. to continue our road work and our transportation and enhance our transportation system, we're paying claims. And we have people at MnDOT and our contractors who are spending hundreds and hundreds of hours dealing with this claims process, which, because the funding, again, is dedicated, it seems so unnecessary. No, but I, like everybody else, did not like the shutdown and the process that we went through, and we went to some great lengths, including going before Judge Guerin and the district court to see if we couldn't get her to decide that constitutionally these are dedicated funds. We have contracts and obligations to meet that we should be meeting, and the cost was going to be horrific, strike the word horrific, substantial. I don't want the press to go out there and say, Ginsey said it's horrific, because we don't know that yet. But we're still. Can I go off the record for a minute, Senator? But anyhow, transportation is unique in a lot of ways. And so I just hope that you can support this bill and also on the floor support the other transportation contingency funding bills. And Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to speak in support of this bill, and my reason is because I think we have to look at each of these bills on an individual basis. I agree with you, Mr. Chair. This particular bill, we're talking about counties and municipalities, and we're talking about public safety. And quite frankly, when we're talking about public safety, I'm infuriated when politics get in the way of public safety. There's just no sense to that at all. And that's what this bill is talking about. If you would have had a construction project that would have been delayed a year and that bridge out for another year, that's a major public safety issue. And there's no sense to have politics in the middle of that. I also sit on the Jobs Committee. And in the Jobs Committee, what we heard time after time, they all said it in a little different way, but the testimony we heard was run a good state. And what that means to me is, coming from a business perspective, I know how to run a good business. And last summer did not feel like we were running a good business here when we were running our state. And quite frankly, I think what each of these bills does is we have to look at each one of them on its own merit for, is it a safety issue? Does it make common sense? We need some common sense back in our government here. Man, is there a lack of common sense here sometimes? With what happened last summer was a major lack of common sense. And, you know, if my dad ever taught me one thing, one main thing, is if you have no common sense, then you're not going to be very successful. And quite frankly, what I want to see is I want to see us run this state better. I want to make sure that we're doing the right things for the future. And right now, if what we can do, if we can take the parts that are just political toys out of this, and I think it should be up to us. It should be up to us as legislators to decide if something needs to stay open or not. It shouldn't necessarily be just up to the courts to decide that. We're legislators. It's up to us to put forward what we think should be taken out of the political process. So, I mean, you guys know I have some bills that are speaking to this, and I think we do have to decide, and it's up to us with the governor to decide. We got our job done last year, and the governor disagreed. Ultimately, we came back to the table when he called us back. But what we have to do is we have to decide right now if some of these bills have merit, and I hope the governor signs these bills and takes this group of situations out of the political process. And then if we're in the future, if we are arguing about money, we can argue about that. But at least we're not damaging the state in the process. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
I'd like to renew my motion.
Senator Hall renews his motion that Senate File 2172 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. A roll call has been requested.
Senator Gimsey.
Aye.
Senator Howe.
Aye.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator DeCryf?
Aye.
Senator Gazelka?
Aye.
Senator Koch?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Yes.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Lori?
No.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Reinhart?
No.
Senator Rest?
No.
Senator Sharon?
No.
Senator Sieben?
No.
Senator Wolf?
Yes.
There being 9 yeses and 6 noes, the motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Senator Fischbach.
Thanks.
Senate File 1460. Senator Fischbach.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I appreciate you. I guess you had to switch things around a little bit because of my time today. So I appreciate that, Senator. Basically, Senate File 1416 sets up a process for unaffixing manufactured homes from real property. And I don't know if you have a fiscal note or not, but there is. We had one in jobs, and then we've got an updated one that's a zero. So I do understand it goes to judiciary, but we probably won't end up going to finance then. But I think for the sake of time, I will ask Mr. Bruner to give a little more explanation.
Mr. Bruner, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. And what the bill does is address an issue where a manufactured home that's affixed or attached to real property or land, perhaps financed with a conventional mortgage, needs to be unaffixed from the land to be sold separately. Perhaps it's a foreclosure or some other some other reason where you might want to be able to sell the home separately from the land. Currently, the Department of Public Safety doesn't have the authority to issue a title for a manufactured home that's unaffixed when no title was originally issued. And the reason we're sort of in the quandary we're in is in 2005, U.S. Bank, and at the behest of Freddie Mac, issued a memorandum stating that they would not finance a manufactured home with a conventional mortgage if a particular state didn't require that there be no title issued for that manufactured home if it were going to become real property and financed with a conventional mortgage. At that time, what Minnesota did was issue titles for all manufactured homes and then require that if they become affixed to real property, that they then have to surrender the title. What we did in 2005 was change our law so that manufactured homes, which at that time were about 75-80% of all the new homes we sold became affixed to real property, there would not be a title issued for that new home, period, if it became affixed. So looking actually to that in the last 2 weeks of the session and then not looking ahead to an issue of wanting to unaffix those homes, there was just no process put in place that would allow that to happen so that a title could be issued when none had never been issued previously. We've worked with the Department of Public Safety on the bill language. We made some accommodations along the way to address their issues. We've worked with the Minnesota Association of Realtors, have their support. We've worked with Wells Fargo, have their support, and we've also been working with the Minnesota Bar Association and Land Title Association to address their concerns.
Okay. Any questions? Senator DeCryf?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 1416 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Senator DeCryf? Senator DeCraft has moved that Senate File 1416 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. Any further discussion? Anybody in the audience wishes to testify for or against the bill? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
I'm opposed to this next one. Opposed to this next one.
The school buses?
Oh, no, I thought it was his.
Next up is Senator Wolf.
I hate it, too.
I'm going to lecture on the floor. I'm bored. Sleep last night. I'm sorry. Tony, he's mad at me.
Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to move Senate File 2166.
Senator Wolf moves that Senate File 2166 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. To the bill. Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you want to do this first. I have an amendment. That's appropriate to do it first. And I will, to the amendment as well as to the bill, I'm going to have Sergeant Davis take over in the explanation.
Okay, Senator Wolf, is this a delete everything amendment?
No.
Okay, it's an author's A1 amendment. Why don't we go ahead and move that amendment? Senator Wolf moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? I suppose we'd like to see it. Well, to the amendment, I see it's just a few words that have been added here. To the amendment, Senator Wolf.
I'll leave that to Sergeant Davis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Sergeant
Paul Davis, Minnesota State Patrol, out of the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. The amendments before you in the A1 deal with us wishing to amend the rules for the commissioner when it comes to the inspection of school buses and simply removing the word point from the process. We've been in discussions with the industry. The point system was developed, just for some background information, back in the very early 1970s and have been addressed throughout the years and updated. And we've had discussions with the industry folks, and I think that there's a need to move to something different. And unfortunately, we cannot have that discussion with the word point currently in the statute. So if we could just strike that word from there, that would allow us to have those discussions and possibly move forward to a new system while still obviously leaving something in statute to perform our duties.
Again, Senator Wolf moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 2166. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. To the bill, Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I will allow Sergeant Davis to explain the bill.
Sergeant Davis.
Mr. Chairman, a question for you. Would you prefer to just kind of generalize it, or would you like me line by line?
Just a general summary of the bill, I believe, would be fine, Sergeant Davis.
Thank you, sir. On the front pages of the bill, the national standards adopted. A little background, the National Congress on School Bus Transportation, specifications and procedures. This conference meets every 5 years and is the safety advocacy group that does determine how a school bus will be built to what standards. Again, they meet every 5 years. They've been meeting since 1939, adjusting these rules as we go along. Whole idea behind it is obviously to produce the most safest vehicle for our children to get to and from school and school-related activities. The bill before you is a cooperative effort between the industry and the department, and we are making just some minor changes to conform to the new 2010 national standard from the previous 2005 standard. Moving forward, as we get over to subdivision 5, where we talk about the colors, I provided for the committee some photographs, which will help, I think, probably better explain what it is. And again, these are Minnesota-specific issues that industry has asked. We've agreed to specific to our buses in our state. They've requested have that black continue to be put around the lights. It does aid in the identification of the bus and for the light itself for dispersing. So it does draw a little bit more attention to the vehicle. As we move down into Section 4, we're talking about the seat and the crash barriers. We are deleting that section with regards to the minimum cushion height. That is being deleted because that is the 05 standard. By adoption of the 2010 standard, it is already adopted in here that the seat height on all buses manufactured for distribution in our state after December 31st of 2012 would go to a 24-inch seat. So we would just mirror the language that's in the book. Moving on to Subdivision 28, the auxiliary fans. Again, if you look at the document provided with the photos, the issue with this is that when we start putting students inside that compartment on our cold winter mornings and evenings, the windshields begin to fog. These fans allow the driver to independently turn them on and off and continue to keep that windshield clear and obviously giving them the visibility to see where they need to be moving to. As we move on to Subdivision 29, the video systems, what we're doing with this particular piece of language was is industry has come to us on a few occasions and asked us about the installation of camera systems and their placements in the vehicle. We never had any language by statute or by rule as to placement of that system. So in sitting down with them, this gives us an opportunity to have that dialogue and now gives us some clarification as to where cameras may be placed and what type may be placed in the vehicle. The idea of mounting some of it over the seat backs is so that as the students stand up in the bus, we're not banging our heads. And as we move on to the Section 7, the repealer piece, what that is having discussion about is with our non-yellow vehicles is the removal of having the requirement to carry the large box of safety triangles in that vehicle.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Parr.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I see it doesn't have any fiscal note to MnDOT, but what are the bus companies thinking of this? I guess I'm just thinking about with these changes, are they prepared? Because obviously there's got to be a cost to them as they purchase new or retrofit buses, if that's what they do.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. And we sort of are about half the industry. Half the industry is independently contracted for delivery of students by bus. And school districts themselves they do it internally within the school district for school buses. So we're about half and half. To answer your question, we've been prepared for this for a number of years. This is somewhat perfunctory that the national standards were going to be updated last year due to no fault of anybody in this committee or other acts of the legislature did not become law last year. And we've been very prepared for them. The adopting these standards by reference in state law, we've been prepared for. The four exceptions or five exceptions that are written in this bill are what we've agreed to with the St. Paul, with the State Patrol, and we find them to be very acceptable. One caveat is the department, the State Patrol, and the Office of Public Safety would like to change the grading policy or the grading standard for how you determine if a bus is worthy to go out into service in the day, from a point system to a pass-fail system. We're not overly enthralled with that, but at the same time, we're willing to work with the State Patrol and their Driver and Vehicle Services Department in order to work that out. It won't happen fast. It will be done by rule, and we are very willing to work with the agency to get that figured out. And obviously, if that does not work out so well, we will be here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was still kind of looking at a price. You know, with these upgrades, what kind of stress is that going to put on schools and the that are buying their own buses and the private sector folks that are buying their buses?
I think the predominant, Mr. Chair, Representative Perry, or Senator Perry, I'm sorry, the predominance of these things are sort of well known a couple of years in advance. And if you're buying new school buses, then they meet these standards already. The key word in my industry, for at least the people I represent, the School Board Operators Contractors Association, is retrofitting. We do not want to go back and rehab our buses and retrofit them to meet some new standards into the future. But when purchasing new buses, which are a little spendy, you know, these buses are $100,000 a piece, we're prepared, you know, and the inclusion of these standards on the cost of a new school bus are not measurable. They're small, and some of these things that are required in contracts between school districts and the school bus operators. So kind of even if it wasn't in statute, as long as the school district would require that of us in a contract, we'd have to provide it.
Okay.
Thank you for that, Ms. Bears-Kowski. Question for you. On line 1.4, subdivision 3, rules of the commissioner, we're doing rulemaking here. Explain that, because it's talking about provide by rule for the issuance and display. So I'm trying to see if understand if, in fact, we are going through a rulemaking process or not.
Ms. Berzovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, it's the rulemaking authority has already been given in statute. This is a modification of existing rulemaking authority, and I am not familiar enough with the rule to know whether it now has to, whether the department has to go back and initiate a rulemaking to affect this change.
Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Perry, it would allow the department to go forward and promulgate a rule if it wishes under their own authority to change the grading authority, the grading standard for how to determine if a bus is worthy to go out to service in the morning. They're removing the word point system because the department and the State Patrol and the Driver Vehicle Service Inspectors are considering going to a pass-fail standard. And we're not overly okay with that yet, but we're prepared to deal with the State Patrol and the Office of Driver and Vehicle Services and work that out. I believe, as Ms. Berzovsky said, that they have the authority to do this anyway, except for that one phrase, point system, does not allow them to go to a pass-fail system, which is their desire. Direction.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, if I may.
Please proceed.
Under the...
Mr. Chair, I'm just, for some reason, I'm feeling a little uncomfortable here not hearing this bill, because I'm not getting a clear picture on exactly what allowing the commissioner, how far we're allowing him to go in this rulemaking process. And just based on some of the bills that have come before my committee and the concerns about rulemaking, I'm not so sure that my committee shouldn't take a quick look at this. I guess that would be my request. I'm just not comfortable with what I'm hearing.
It's your prerogative, as chair. You can refer it to your committee. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. In section...
Let me go back and see which section. 5, subdivision 29, references the video mobile surveillance systems. Maybe Senator Wolf, this question can be for you or whoever whom you designated. Where does the surveillance go? Who is seeing this and how is it used?
I think both of us could address that issue.
Yeah, I'd be happy to give it a start, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharan, from the discussions I've had with some of the people in the school district business, I should probably do the caveat that I'm married to the school bus school district lobbyist, that the by contract, according to the people I work for, the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, that we don't own the tape, and that by contract, nor do we discipline students. We report bad behavior on buses. And then it's up to the district to determine whether or not that behavior warrants some sanction, whatever that might be. So we are obligated mostly by contract to either have video cameras on a bus and therefore then deliver that tape disc to the school district at their request. So it's really not our tape or disc as a school bus operator. Basically on a contract as we're providing transportation for the students, and which is the responsibility of the schools, that we don't own the tape.
Senator Sharan?
May I follow? Thank you. So
disc.
You have a tape, and you may observe behavior that is being taped that is troublesome, bullying, or inappropriate. Are you obligated to report that there's something on that tape that the school district should be paying attention to?
Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharan, it's my understanding that there is a list of things that are bad behavior, buses and schools, certainly loading in the loading zone, in the off zone at school, you know, so on and so forth, being dropped off in the neighborhood where the students live, that they're very prescriptive and just in the description of what is quote-unquote bad behavior. And it's not up to us to decide if it is. I think we err on the side of could it be or would it be described as bad behavior, and then we just provide the in this case, a record to the school districts for them to determine whether disciplinary action is warranted or not.
Senator Sharan?
Thank you. I'd be curious to know of that process if there's some place that I can go to get more information about what happens to that information and how it's utilized and what that criteria is. That would be helpful to me. And the second question I have is on Section 8, duty to report, Section 8, Subdivision 2. At the very end of that, there's a change in the legislation, Senator Wolf. It changes the duty, the reporting school official shall issue a report to the commissioner of public safety concerning the incident, duty to report incident, upon the request of the commissioner. That's a change from an automatic reporting, I think, on a pre-approved form developed by the commissioner. I would like to understand what the reasoning is behind that change and why that helps the students who are to be protected because of the implementation of these rules.
Mr. Chair,
Sergeant Davis.
Senator, this particular statute, as my understanding, was developed back in about 1995 during one of the governor's initiatives. You have the mandatory reporting here, and that the reporting school official shall issue a report to the Commissioner of Public Safety concerning the incident on a form developed by. That form was never developed, and we now have other ways of obtaining that information through the court system or through the local police departments. And in some cases, it may be unlikely that the school may not be aware of everything that occurs, whereas if the police department is involved, we'll be able to get that record that way and be able to get a little bit more information. And it just allows the commissioner an opportunity or the department to go back and ask for additional information, and that's why we're just simply leaving the door open a little bit upon request of the commissioner.
Okay.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess whoever would like to address this, I think Senator Sharon brings up some great points that I guess I'd like to take it in a little bit different direction. There are folks who I would envision would want or could potentially use these tapes for not-so-nice means. So I guess my question is, how often are these discs rotated? How long are they kept? Are they destroyed? Are they inventoried? What are some of the processes that go along with that?
Mr. Kelleher?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, you know, the fast answer is I'm not sure. I think it's predicated in the contracts between the school districts and the contracts with us as the bus operators. I don't know what the data retention is. I would imagine I shouldn't hazard a guess if there's a state law around data retention in regards to this. I don't know. We can get you the answer to how long we retain those discs. But I would imagine it's predicated upon our contractual relationship with the school districts. It's basically their data that we just record because we're transporting those students on behalf of the school district.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, may I weigh in for a second?
Davis.
I do have some background information for you with regards to this. The image is captured either via a tape or in most cases what industry has moved to is a hard drive computer data system. It is always recording. And the question is then, it's all secured in a box. You have to have encryption decoding software to even begin to view any of the images off of the hard drive. The hard drive needs to be removed from the bus, brought into a facility where the encryption can be done. Those images that are captured, the ones that I have had the opportunity to view, do become immediate property of the school district. Data privacy with regards to images of the students captured on the bus are of grave concern to the district as well as to us. Typically, I can report, at least for the Noka-Hennepin School District, where I've requested copies, where we've been called in to do an investigation, there is a process in place where you sign for that information. We guard that disk with our lives, literally, and look at that data privacy issue that nobody wants that information out there. We don't provide extra copies. We bring that matter to court, and then typically once court is done, we ask to have that disk destroyed. And that way we, again, leave it back to that the district really retains the original copy, and we do not have any possession thereof.
And Mr. Chairman and Sergeant, I would be, you know, interested in hearing about or making sure that there is some kind of finite statute of limitations that we would keep on these things. I mean, I have some real concerns about that data just being out there perpetually and not having an end date, especially with some recent things that have happened in our school districts.
Senator Lori, did you have a comment to that point? Okay. Senator Howell, you've been waiting patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a couple questions about what we do here in Minnesota. I know we have the National Congress on School Transportation, but I'm wondering what we do locally for, like, best practices. And I do support Senator Wolf, the swing arm. I think school districts do take care in how they route their buses, so, you know, they try and get as many kids not to have to cross the street as possible. But I'm just wondering, what do we do on a state level as far as getting the bus operators together to talk about best practices?
I have a fine answer for that.
Mr. Keller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howe, with the support and action of the State Patrol, the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association has sent out letters to basically every school bus operator in the state, public or private, and are having three different or five, I think it's three, training sessions around the state this spring. Paul, Sergeant Davis can help me with the term of art, but it's a safety and
a compliance and outreach program is what we're partnering with them.
That we initiated that we would like to have as many school buses be as safe as humanly possible. And with the State Patrol and our own organization, we are having these statewide meetings. We try to do them as regionally as possible to encourage everybody, whether they're in our association or not, public or private, to come and have a discussion about safety and compliance. Make sure that everybody knows what the standards are, what the rules are, and what is the best practices, to use your term, for providing safe student transportation.
May I follow up on that, Mr. Chair?
Sergeant Davis.
We, Senator, we meet typically almost on a monthly basis through the School Bus Issues Committee and through the Department of Education. So we do have that dialogue on a regular basis. Also during the summer month, we have two conferences that we attend with MSBOA, our private contractor group, and MAPT, our school district group. Also in the month of July, both operators put together a train-the-trainer session where we bring in the folks that do train our school bus drivers together and sit down, and we go over the model school bus driver training manual. Students with disabilities, many, many things are covered in that and provide to them that additional training to ensure, as Mr. Kelleher said, that we are providing the best possible transportation for the students.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up. Is this how many years have you been doing what Mr. Kelleher is talking about?
Or is actually, the Kelleher? Safety and compliance seminars, this is the first year we're going to do it, and we hope that it works very well. We sent out a survey to basically every licensed bus driver or bus contractor, public or private, in the state, and encouraged them to come to these meetings. They're free, and they're in public locations. My organization is going to pay for the pop and the donuts or whatever. And we just want everybody to come. And the State Patrol is going to do a couple of seminars. We're going to do a couple of seminars about, you know, how to prepare for inspections, how to best do, as you described, best practices, so we don't have any accidents.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just also think maybe I think that's a great idea, and I wish you good luck on that. And maybe you might want to extend the offer maybe to local school boards, too, if members want to come, you know, if it's
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howe, I can assure you the school boards are informed.
All right. Fabulous. Thanks.
Any further discussion? Not. Senator Wolf renews her motion that Senate File 2166 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. Any further discussion?
Guy from the audience.
Anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill?
Hello, my name's Dan Lim. I'm from Monticello, Minnesota. I'm here on my own, but I just happened to be at the Capitol visiting today, and this was going on, and I thought I'd stick my head in and give my cent and a half, which I'm good at doing. I've worked for a bus company for about part-time for 4 years. There's a question I have, and I don't know all the small words, is why they want to change the video. Because by what I've seen, I don't drive bus. I just kind of do groundwork at a bus company. But it's more on a route-by-route basics that they need cameras, that not every bus needs to have a camera. And that's usually between the school bus company and the district. And they seem to do a very good job from what I've seen in my district on which routes need photo cameras and don't. The other one little thing I had was he said something about not wanting to carry those triangular signs in non-bus color vehicles. Is that what I understood?
Yes, sir. What we're talking about is the Type 3 vehicle. Yes.
The diamonds. Well, I would say that's plus if they ever would get in an accident or if they'd have trouble on the road. I've never seen one, but it does give the people coming up on that this is not just an ordinary van, that it's a school van. So I would be disagreeing with him on not leaving them in them, making them carry it, because most of them now are carrying them anyway. But anyway, those are just my set and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Lem. Appreciate your testimony. Any further discussion? To the motion, Senator Wolf's motion to re-refer the bill to the State Government Innovation and Veterans Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Now we have Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate File 2054 before you.
Senator Lori, to the bill.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. It's a pretty straightforward bill. Directs the Commissioner of Transportation to make wireless internet service available at our safety rest areas. And instructs them to use private sources if they can find those funds in exchange for publicity. Honestly, I just got the fiscal note. It came out at 12:58 this afternoon, and in time for the committee. And this was a bill that was brought to me by a constituent who is now retired, just recently retired, and began traveling this great country in vehicles, and was really impressed in several states that he visited when they had wireless service in their rest areas. And he emailed me and said Minnesota should think about this. And I thought it's a good enough point to merit a conversation. So I asked that this bill be drafted up. We've now got the fiscal note. So, you know, some of the benefits of the bill, I think that it would encourage people to use our rest areas for getting off the highway, getting a period of rest, and give them an additional use when they're there in order to check their emails and really get off the road for some of that, too. I think right now the distracted driving issues are mounting constantly, and this could – it's not a silver bullet. It's not the solution to everything, but I think giving them an option to get off the road and have decent wireless internet could really make our rest areas more user-friendly and encourage broader use and enhance the safety features that our rest areas are there to provide. So that said, we did get our fiscal note. I don't know if members have a printed version of it yet. I can give it to you in summary.
We just received it.
You did, okay. Lori, so, yeah. It's $216,000 in year one for purchase and installation of the equipment, and $165,000 basically every year going forward. There's 54 rest areas that they are talking about, which includes 10 travel information centers. Those are the bigger ones. 3 regional welcome centers. I think those are the ones like when you're coming into the state, and then an additional 41 class 1 rest areas, which are the ones essentially on the major interstate systems and the like. And so it's $2,800 a year for the internet services, and $250 per rest area. That comes to the $165,000 a year. So, you know, I think it's good to have this information available to us. I guess I'm not going to make a huge push and say that this is the absolute best use of our money, but I think it's a valid conversation point, and I hope it gets some good discussion, and we can maybe think of additional ways to approach this. One thing that I will note in the fiscal note as I read it is other states have tried this approach to try to get some promotional manner to offset some of the costs. My understanding is that DOT did pretty due diligence to look, and apparently this is not a brand new concept, and nobody has to date been successful in attracting that local private partner. And so they, you know, probably rightfully didn't include any shared costs. We can continue to pursue that, and maybe we can come to a different place and pursue it further. But appreciate the committee's committee time and consideration of this, and stand for any questions.
Mr. Chair. Burr. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senator Laurie, I love the idea. I would be, you know, if there was a way that we could change the wording in here where we would have the Commissioner of Transportation request RFPs for the installation and service thereof, including all maintenance, blah, 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 whatever it is, to wireless providers that are interested at their cost, I think it's a great thing. And I think this is a good time for me to bring up another little issue that I've received a letter, and you can see it's handwritten, from a person who questions why, and this is for DOT, why the electronic sign down by the Iowa border on I-35 in the northbound lane very rarely even gets used as far as turned on. And so I'm thinking to myself, if we're installing, and I understand that the DOT installed six of these signs just recently or in a short period of time at other rest stops or travel information centers, if you want to call them that. I don't know if they're working, but if we're spending dollars to do this, then let's find a way to either use them or not waste the money in the installation. Hence, that's why I'm saying I would love to see this move through. I think you've got a great point. I think it's a great idea to be able to slide off the road at a rest stop and, you know, pull up your iPad or whatever. And I can see that Senator Howe is willing, you know, I think he has stocks or something, or has his own, but I just think it's great. What a great partnership if we could get these wireless companies to jump on board and just handle the whole thing for us, and they maintain it, their cost. So I would, however we would do that, suggest that would be the next thing that you would look at, Senator.
Senator Perry, I would be concerned about sicking MnDOT on it. It might become a two-year project, and we'll pay equal to this probably in wages and benefits, but just a little editorial there. But, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I like the concept, Senator Laurie, and hopefully we'll be able to find a way to resolve this. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really along the same lines, I like the idea, but I look at what – they say it's going to cost them to do it, and it's unbelievable. $4,000 per area to set up, but then your internet costs are $2,800 per location, and or $2,800 per location. And think about what internet costs you in your home. You know, $20 a month, you know, or somewhere in that neighborhood. And so I love the idea, and if that's where they are, maybe part of it is we get a competitive bid outside of that to see, and I'm quite certain that we would save quite a bit of money. Good idea.
Senator Hall?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Perry, I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, I think it's a great idea, and Senator Laurie, but I do think that, you know, I think technology is advancing so fast already. I mean, most people have internet on their cell phones or their smartphones right now, and you know, it's landline and things of that nature almost going by the wayside. I think that, you know, to Senator Gazalka's point, that, you know, to have a repeater station there, whether it's one of the big telecom providers that could have a place there and either sell it, you know, where people could log on for 24 hours for X amount of dollars, or buy a state pass or whatever, or run advertisements on the column. You know, I'm sure MnDOT checked into all those deals, but I think eventually the private market is going to get there. And I would just caution us to mandate it or to say that the government is going to do it, because, again, it is a service provided. And it's a kind of a double-edged sword. I think it would be great for people to check weather and check all other things, but if they're pulling off into a rest area to actually rest, they need to be resting. I get after my teenage kids for not, you know, going to bed on time because they're on the internet. So we do want to make sure that, especially when truck drivers and things are taking their rest breaks, that they actually are resting. And but I think it's an idea that has merit. I just don't want to mandate it at this point.
Senator Lohr?
Mr. Chair, all really valid points, and I'll tell you a little bit about how this came about. And I'm not opposed to working with the department on considering an RFP and seeing if we couldn't get the costs under control to further it. And truthfully, it initially came back to me as a study to think about, you know, what it might look like. And I said, nah, just write the bill as a mandate so that we have the costs in front of us. What will it cost? So I'm not wedded to a mandate that we do this, but I thought that it would be important to just say, if we just plain did it, what would it cost for the sake of discussion in terms of what might we accomplish? And so I think that achieved its goal and pulled this information out and put it in front of us all, and I'm not opposed to taking another direction. I think that it is a service that could be used. I think that the rest component, you are resting. You're doing something different with your eyes and with your body. I mean, the white lines, you know, out on the highway, the fatigue is from that.
That
repetitive
that
same motion. Oh, that's Highway 210. all the way east west. All those east west roads.
Those are wake up bumps.
Yeah. Oh, is that what they are? They lulled me. They lulled me after a while. Anyway, getting off the highway, getting in a different routine can serve to recharge your brain, whether you're looking at it or not. And it can, you know, if you have better service at the rest area than the wireless that's available out on the highway, it can also encourage you to pull off to do that checking rather than sit while you're trying to drive and do double duty, the distracted driving scenario. So, I mean, I liked the concept and wanted to foster the dialogue, and I think it's been a good one, and I really do appreciate the committee's time and indulgence. And so,
well, Senator Lohr, would you be amenable to a friendly amendment on line 1.6, striking the word shall and replacing that with may?
Actually, yes. Yeah, that'd be fine. And, you know, with that, it's possible that the department – so, yeah, I will move that on line 1.6 we strike the word shall and replace it with the word may.
Senator Lohr has moved a verbal amendment that on line 1.6, striking the word shall and replacing it with the word may.
Before we move on that, you know, I'd strike the shall on 1.7 and replace it with may as well, given the difficulties that they've apparently had attracting those local private partners, and just say that they may do that if they find a viable alternative too, and make it permissive. And with that, you know, I would think that, you know, maybe in some of the larger rest areas that get more traffic, maybe it might make sense to make this smaller investment in a couple of them. I don't know. Giving them the option makes some sense.
Senator Lohr, talking about it and thinking about the replacing that shall on line 1.7, the rest of the sentence does say to the extent available. And so it does give them the flexibility, I think.
Well, I don't read it that way necessarily, because let's say a really unreasonable, you know, something that they didn't consider reasonable. Reasonable is open to interpretation. If a bid that they didn't like came forward, if it says they shall, you know, it could be construed that they would have to take a bid that didn't appear favorable to the people of Minnesota. So I'd hate to bind them to something that they didn't think worked. Would be my reason for shall, or for a change from shall to may on line 1.7.
Okay, so your verbal amendment would be on line 1.6, remove shall and replace it with may, and on 1.7, likewise, remove shall and replace it with may.
Yep.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Senator?
I thought we were using the word encourage now, Mr.
Yes, strongly encourage.
Strongly.
No, really.
Amending the amendment, yeah. Senator Dibble.
Council has also pointed out that on line 1.2, we would need to strike requiring and replace that with authorizing.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Senator Laurie, I think what we will do is lay this on the table or hold it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus finance bill.
That sounds great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
It'll have to be a finance bill, Senator Laurie,
yep.
When we come forward with a supplemental. So,
right.
Thank you. Having concluded our
Mr.
business,
Chair,
I do
Mr.
want to,
Chair.
Senator Perry.
I just want to bring up one. I brought up this letter for a purpose because there is some concern, and there is another section to it. Is, at this particular south rest stop, this travel information center, it amazes me that there are. I've been told there's DOT drivers who have requested this sign to be utilized, and it goes on deaf ears. The other thing that's amazing is the fact that, and I do know because we stop at that when we come back from Iowa seeing our grandkids at that rest stop, and I do know for a fact that there are hookups for weather and traffic monitors in the building, and I don't know that I've seen them work. And so when I've asked, I said, are they actually working? And they go, no, they're not, and they haven't for some time. So I don't know if by bringing this up here at this meeting would maybe spur some action by the department to check into these and maybe get back to us. I mean, it concerns me that if we have this and they were originally installed for safety and if we're not using them, then we're not using the citizens' money that they give us the citizens' money correctly for these items. So just for you, Mr. Chair.
I guess we could call up the department. Mr. Rudin is still here. If you'd like to come and discuss this with us, we'll take this opportunity. And while we have just a moment, I just want to say that beginning next Tuesday, we will be rolling out our omnibus policy 2 bill, our second one for this year, and taking up a discussion on that. And we will discuss it on Tuesday, take amendments, and vote on the bill next Thursday. So just so you have a heads up on what's happening here coming up next week. Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and I'm not familiar with the situation that Senator Perry has brought up, but we'll be happy to look into both of those things and get back to you.
Okay. Seeing no other business, the committee is adjourned.